Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I'm your host, Andrew Jelina. With me this week is Damian Scott, Managing Director of New York for Rightpoint. Damian, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Andrew.
So I understand, like many folks we've talked to way back in the day, there was a computer in the house, in your case, an Atari, that was kind of a bridge to the computing world.
Yeah, it was an Atari 800, very high power, probably had about 8 bytes of memory. I think one of the things we learned early on as technologists, how do you do more with less? And it's one of the luxuries that we have today. How can we do more with more? This is a great thing at the time we're in now, right? We have all the memory you need and all the storage you need, and how do we take advantage of it?
Yeah, now it's people in productivity that we're all trying to figure out how to get everything into the box. So you originally, I think, wanted to be a journalist?
Yeah, I think early on for me, I loved writing. I was part of the school newspaper. I enjoyed that. And as we got more into computers, funny thing about it is I started with the coding side of it and creating games, creating whatever we could, right? And one of the fun parts was really creating audio as the computers got a little more powerful. And I started to really enjoy the hardware side of it. So I decided, you know, let me switch and look at engineering and chip design and what it is to make these things really operate.
I think in undergrad, you were at the Rochester Institute of Technology.
Yeah, so I ended up at RIT, which has a great computer engineering program. Put a little plug in for my alma mater, still continues to be great. Spent a lot of time learning chip design, coding in the chip, but as part of that, you had to learn the software and coding side of it. So I think an interesting side effect of what I learned was the software, but also how everything worked deep down in the guts of the hardware. So it really helped as we kind of got into the early days of how do we make computers do what they need to do for end users, right? Given some of the limitations we had.
And being at RIT, you must have gone to Nick Tahoe's more than once for the garbage plate.
I spent a few nights there. It seemed like every time we ended up at Nick Tahoe's, there was a bit of a competition. What was the worst food you could eat on top of the Nick Tahoe's garbage plate? So not that the garbage plate was bad enough for you already. We had to find something extra in order to tie into that. But it is a famous location for little old Rochester.
I met a friend at a co-op while I was at UMass, and he was from RIT. He's like, you got to come out. And so I drove all the way out to Rochester. We went out at night and then ended up at Nick Tahoe's late night, which I remember to this day.
Yeah, it's still there and still serving the garbage plate.
God bless him. So after you graduated college, then what?
Interesting, when you talked about co-op, and one of the great things about RIT was the co-op program. And I came out of college in early 90s, and the business climate was not great. So through the co-op program, I got a job at IBM in their research division. First off, helping fix IBM PCs, XTs. The PS2 had just come out and pulling chips, pushing chips in. And it was an interesting time, but very hard to make things work. I have a funny story trying to make these computers work. These are scientists, right? I work with the folks that invented the hard drive, right? We invoke the folks that invented speech. When you go on your computer and you get that little stick in the middle, right? I made that guy's IBM PC XT work for him. So that was really fun times, but they didn't really respect computers. They just needed them to work. So I went into one guy's office one time and he kept saying, this computer keeps giving me trouble. I can't understand it. Every time it slows down, and he takes his foot and kicks it under the desk and the top comes popping off. And I said, then it starts working again, but this time it just won't start. So it's a very interesting place with some very finicky machines.
What do you do, like unseat some connectors or something?
The whole top popped off. These things were very brittle back in the day, right? And it's not like these things work great. So cards were coming out of slots, wires were coming disconnected, chips were coming loose. In the end, he just needed the thing to work so he could study the impacts of weather across the globe. That was the goal.
So after that, you wanted to get yourself involved with some high transaction systems. I think you ended up touching Prodigy Internet back in the day.
Yeah, I actually left IBM. And one of the reasons I left was we were doing a lot of coding and software for systems management and desktop management. And I thought, I want to get really closer to making really hard problems and solving hard problems for computers. And moved on to Cambridge Technology Partners, where I had two really interesting projects. One was making a system that is for Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital that was used to decide which treatment pathways are going to be most effective for cancer patients. So how do you pull all that data together? How do you put someone's diagnosis in there? And do you go left or do you go right? And if you go left, how do you track it? And how does that affect their morbidity? Do they survive or do they die and what happens? So I was the lucky guy that got to write all the reports around morbidity rates and the impact of those pathways on morbidity. Lots of data. Lots of information to chop through, right? I think that kind of got me into architecting large, complex solutions. And then I moved on to help Prodigy Internet, which for those of us from our time, they were our only way on to the information highway early on. But at that point, they were on the downslide a little, right? They were trying to figure out, how do I recapture the market? How do I better support my customers and help them architect a solution to support 25,000 calls a day, supporting a multi-million user base, right? Which was massive at the time. Yes, it was declining, but certainly massive.
Yeah, I remember Cambridge Technology Partners, my old company, Web Technology Partners, name partially stolen from them. We used to run into them in this account of ours up in Lowell, Massachusetts all the time, see those guys in there and sometimes getting the occasional architecture war over this or that. But yeah, I remember seeing them everywhere during the late 90s.
Yeah, we were all over Boston and it grew a lot in New York. I would say 20% of the folks I work with today came from my Cambridge Technology Partners roots.
So
I work with a number of people that we've been two or three companies together, not together, but been a great fraternity, I'll say.
That's cool. So I know more recently you've been working on some big transactional systems. You talked about on the pre-call a bit, Goldman Sachs.
Yeah. So I think a lot of our work today is in banking and not so much on consumer-based .com sites, but how do you really move transactions and large volumes of transactions? I would say two interesting things we did there. Helping them to kind of architect and shift systems from larger transaction amounts and smaller transaction volumes, which is used for more business to business, to how do you support a consumer, right? Which is smaller transaction amounts, higher volumes, and re-architecting that and thinking through things like reactive code with Java, right? And how do you make sure nothing falls out as this thing is being scaled? So we spent a lot of time over the last couple of years partnering with Goldman, partnering with other banks as well, kind of figure out how we make that shift. And we're seeing a bit of a trend, I would say, with a lot of the banks that maybe were business to business, like Goldman, shifting to consumer-based banking. It's all money, but it's a different way of doing it.
Now, are they helping power the Apple credit card?
They are the settlement engine and the transaction engine behind the credit card. That was a huge initiative. I was there when we made that pivot from working on traditional lending, and then that deal came across. It was a lot of work. It happened very quickly. And this is an example. I think Goldman Sachs, a lot of our companies we work with, they're great examples of how do you get teams to work quickly and take advantage of the technology opportunities in front of them to deliver amazing solutions? They came to market with Marcus Lending in a year, right? The credit card probably took a year or less. I mean, these things happen very quickly. And how do you bring together teams to do that was a little bit of magic, which I thought was great.
How did you get the non-technical folks to sign off on everything you needed to do there? I imagine to get it going that quickly, you probably pulled in some open source components here and there.
Yeah, you look at it, it's a lot about the technology and you're working in financial services and banking industry. It's around compliance, risk. What does this mean for our business long term? What exposures do we have to take into account? So as a technologist, I think one of the parts that I made a switch in my career is really thinking about the business implications of technology and how do you communicate those. And for those of you that are deep down in the code, that are every day just coding away, think about how you can make an impact by taking that depth of understanding and helping to explain it to a lawyer and helping explain it to a risk manager and helping explain it to a business owner and really make that relevant for them. So that's really what we had to do, is go through that and figure out, how did this work? Kind of take baby steps and prove it out. And then ultimately, in some cases, be patient. And maybe we didn't adopt it in the first pass. We adopted it in the second pass or the third. And that's where I think practices like Agile or iterative development come into play.
I think to sell a risk team at a big bank on open source, you're definitely going to need to grease the skids, have a couple small wins, get them to wrap their heads around it before they're going to put anything big on it.
Absolutely.
So it sounds like you've had plenty of experience using a skill that I've definitely had to use, selling a technology idea within a company. Talked an earlier episode with Vikas Singhvi about the hype machine and needing to be able to sell a technology. Where else have you had to do that within your career?
One pivotal one is, and I'll talk about one that maybe didn't go so well, and I'll leave the company unnamed, where the company was making a pretty big switch on their architecture for their underlying products. And the question really is, which architecture should we go with? How do we rebuild these things? And this is an investment where you're going to live it for 10, 15 years, right? Ultimately, while we did the requisite technology work, the requisite architecture work, but ultimately the final decision was based on a business relationship, where we went with technology and stack X when the recommendation was technology and stack Y, which years later proved out to be the wrong decision. And ultimately, thankfully, we built it in a way that it was easy to pivot away from that technology stack. So I think a lesson learned from that is not just to think about the decision, but based on the decision, how are you going to architect the platform so that if something has to change, you can then pivot. because you might not like the technology stack that you're building on as an architect or as a developer. But what are you doing to bring in some of that isolation? And so ultimately, you're de-risking it for the business. So those are some of the things we think about at every step of every decision we make and help to guide our clients.
I talked about in an earlier episode, actually, back when we were working with the Cambridge Technology Partner folks. We were working with a piece of technology and we had to use the bridge pattern in order to abstract away some of the communication stuff that was happening under the covers, just in case the middleware tool didn't work. And lo and behold, it didn't. So we ended up being able to quickly swap that out. And I think there's a balance to strike with your technical debt. You can rip it all together and get it out to market quickly, but if you don't put at least a little abstraction on these other big systems you're touching, it makes it super hard to swap it out down the road if you ever have to. On the other end, there is over-engineering where everything is super abstracted away and there's all these extra levels. How do you kind of figure out the right amount?
Couple of things when you think about that is around the balance. You always consider time because time drives kind of what you can do. So how do you make the right technical decisions that are not going to cause you to rip the system apart later? And then ultimately, make sure you're tracking those so you know you got to go back and address those, whether it's 6 months later or a year later. I'll tell you, we've had clients, though, where time to market was way more important than technical debt or architecture. And as technologists, sometimes we have a hard time understanding that that's not the right way to build that. I wouldn't build that this way. Well, if you want to get it to market in 6 months, you would build it this way. And then you're willing to then go back, redo it, rebuild it, and maybe take a second pass on this platform and get the right thing out because getting to market was more important than having the right long-term architecture and that investment. So those are the things we talk to clients about, understand what are their business drivers. I was part of a company called Tandem 7, and it's acquired by Genpact, and the group is still here today. As many of us have come together with Rightpoint. The company is an experience-led company. Now, experience-led is, yes, there are technology pieces to it, but decisions are driven by what's the ultimate end experience and time to market and value you're delivering for your clients. So those are the things that drove technology decisions, not is it always the best technology, right? Is it always the ideal way to do it? You're trading off, but you're being very transparent in that conversation, and everyone understands it and is bought in.
Now, you did another big project for the federal home loan system as well, right?
Yeah. The FHLs are a semi-independent group of companies that provide mortgage servicing or loans and so on under the guidance of the government. So they have a lot of regulation that they're working within. Interesting about this FHL scenario, they were going through and looking at re-architecting all of their solutions, all their platforms, technology, and the driver was not so much would it bring more revenue, more money, because they only have a certain number of members. So their driver was, how do we increase the customer experience for the members of this FHL group so that we could build this and ultimately make their lives easier and make our lives easier and our employees' lives easier? That really fit well into that experience message. So for them, we looked at it and there was a lot of duct taping in place, a lot of manual processes that were in place that had built up over a long time. And we thought through the problem space, not from a technology point of view, but by starting with understanding the needs of their member banks. The needs of the member bank's customers, what types of things they wanted to do today that they couldn't do, and then use that to come up with the technical requirements and drive pretty much every technology decision around a very comprehensive stack. We looked at data, we looked at integration, we looked at security, as well as the UI and application tiers. I think it was a pretty extensive piece of work.
Now, do they loan just to consumers for mortgages, or do they loan to businesses as well?
Yeah, they do loan to businesses as well. So think of an overnight loan. You might need a loan against some assets to cover something overnight. They will provide short-term loans, and they're large volume loans. And this happens pretty quickly. One of the interesting side effects of that is that kind of investment is a lot of money for one FHL to do. And as we came out of it, they went and looked for final funding to get approval to do this. They needed to reach out to the other FHLs, and FHLs are kind of statewide. There's an FHL San Francisco, there's an FHL Pittsburgh, there's an FHL Boston, they're around the country. And they went out and that architecture ultimately was built in a way and funded in a way that a group of FHLs are getting the benefit of the shared architecture platform as they move along this journey.
Now, did all FHLs or kind of a subset of them get on board this train?
Yeah, I would say a subset initially. Ideally, once this thing starts to get faster and faster, it'll build momentum, but not all. And interesting part about it too is we didn't have that vision from the start. It's how do we build the right architecture and focus on making sure that we could articulate the reasons for those technology decisions and tie them back to customers and member service and user value. And those messages resonated really well with the other FHLs because everyone can talk about customers and end user value. So now they're on board. And I think that's a set of themes that we carry through all our initiatives that we do.
Yeah, it can be difficult to sell to a consortium or a franchise that has a bunch of little independent folks or groups of folks. I imagine some of them must have had some sort of legacy systems or other things that they were tied to. How do you convince them to invest and jump on board when it might mean abandoning something they've already invested in?
The way most times it works, in this case specific for the FHLs, is one, there was a cost savings component to many of the changes, so how it's going to reduce the ongoing cost of ownership. But I think what pushes a lot of people into coming on board was the value it was going to deliver for their employees, both in, yes, in optimizations and efficiencies, but also in higher accuracy, right? Less risk of compliance issues, right? Less failures and less late night phone calls because something broke, right? And ultimately, that means something for their customers, for their member companies. So that's where the big sales, but it's got to tie back to their end user, their end customer, or additional value for the business. We sometimes forget that as technologists.
Now, way back when I was an operations management major, we used to look for, like, if there's a piece of paper that someone's writing stuff down on or printing it out of one system and then entering it into another system, that was an integration opportunity.
That is.
What sort of things do you look for, kind of low-hanging fruit optimizations and processes?
I think similarly, we look for sticky notes. A big part of what we do is contextual inquiry, and we'll go out and just watch what people do. Ask one or two questions, go into the trading floor, go into a financial advisor's process and see what they're doing, you name it, what the end user is. Look at what they're doing, understand, and we'll see if there's a sticky note stuck on your computer or a little piece of tape with a name or a piece of paper on your desk. We'll ask, what's that paper for? Why'd you look at that? And those are the interventions we're looking for. And then probably cases where we identify moments of frustration, because a lot of things still now are online. And one moment of frustration could be friction switching from application one to application two, or application two to three. So we're looking for those throughout it as we're observing what's going on, and that then helps us to pull out scenarios.
Yeah, we did a project for a client and they said, we want to develop this mobile app to manage a fleet of folks that are going to be out in the field doing these mobile installations and repairs. And we suggested, why don't we mock up what we're doing, make like a coarse wireframe and do a simultaneous undercover boss type thing where we go in and follow your installers around and actually document what they're doing. We shot some video. I worked with one of our interns at the time, and we got some video of what actually goes on. And we then showed the folks in the field the wireframes. They had some very good suggestions, like, well, that's actually not how the flow works. You should really reshuffle these screens and add this here and so on. And we went back and we showed it to the CEO. He's like, I had no idea we were doing that in the field. I had no idea that happened. Wait, how often does this happen? It ended up being very eye-opening for them.
Yeah, one of the techniques we're using a lot is journey maps. And how do you map out that end-to-end journey? And one interesting one we did was around a car manufacturer. The end-to-end experience from I think I want that car till I turn it back in. And it wasn't just as the buyer. It was of the dealer. It was of the finance person. It was of the finance person in the dealership, the finance person back at the car manufacturer that was providing the financials. So we had all those connecting points and we were able to visualize that, identify all those friction points, opportunities for both digital intervention, but also process change intervention. Now, one of the goals of this was how do we upscale the service as we were looking at a higher level brand, right, to bring to market. And that resulted in, I would say, about a 25-foot journey map that they posted on their wall in their US headquarters and all the executives used to help to guide decisions even to this day. And it's been probably almost 2 years ago now.
Woohoo! This is my 25th recruiter call for the same job today. New high score!
The 3-week wait between my first interview and my second interview is my favorite time of year.
My recruiter says he is my best friend, but I haven't heard from him since I started the job 2 years ago.
Your background in real estate and multi-level marketing makes you the perfect person to advise me on tech careers.
Finding your next consulting gig should not be this difficult. Quite frankly, you deserve better. Syrinx is the consulting company founded and run by software consultants. We get you. Find out why our employees are some of the happiest and best paid consultants in the industry at syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com. Find a better way today.
Syrinx Consulting is a proud sponsor of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I know you've said that you like solving problems and leading teams, but your kind of big driver is helping customers and value delivery. What does that mean to you?
Yeah, as you look at it, it's great to put the right technology in and help people to build a complex solution. But how do we take a perspective that maybe is technology agnostic? We all, as vendors and suppliers, as consultants, have vendor partners. We know those products very well. And there's a reason why, frankly, we have those partners, because we like them. We think they solve very complex problems. They fit well for our customers. But coming into a problem with a more agnostic view to say, what's the right end solution? How do I take a perspective from a customer's point of view to drive that technology decision? I think one example is we had a client that was really providing 401k services across the market. And they asked us to do an evaluation of products. A couple of them we were partner with and we had experience in. Another one we weren't in. So we really looked at this objectively. And the outcome, interestingly, was Salesforce and their platform, which is not something at the time we had a capability in. The good news is today we do. But ultimately, how do you guide them to that right decision that looks at it from a technology perspective, from a cost perspective, and a long-term ownership? And in this case, that was the right fit for their organization. So we did help support the design and do the design work, but we helped them find another vendor to ultimately do the Salesforce implementation piece, which was the largest part of the work. And I think for us as a business and for everyone, think about it, it's not about getting the whole deal or getting all the money as part of what you're doing. It's how do you get the right answer for clients? And then drive repeat business, right? How do you make sure you're really helping them be successful? And as a business, we probably have a good part of our portfolio, upwards of 60-70% is repeat customers. One of my favorite things is to hear a customer leaves their job and goes elsewhere, because I would say 7 out of 10 times we get a phone call. And that's all tied to value, long-term relationship, and doing the right thing for them.
Yeah, I think sales folks have a bunch of unfair stereotypes hung on them. Consultants tend to have a few hung on them as well. Oh, you're going to come in and you're going to recommend the solution that you have. And any consultant that's been around for a while knows they're much better off treating the client right, getting them to a solution that they need, whether or not it's the one you offer. Because people, like in personal relationships, remember how you made them feel. Did you make them feel like, oh, wow, that's really insightful and you told me the right thing, even though it wasn't necessarily the best thing for you? And they're going to remember that and become repeat customers.
Think about, how do you feel a little uncomfortable as a technology leader when you're helping clients out, when you're recommending? And are you considering new technologies, new opportunities, and at least having the conversation, both internally and with the client, and consciously deciding not to do it? I think one of the things that are moving pretty quickly is the idea of low-code and no-code platforms. It's been tried and tried numerous times. Many of us know about Smalltalk. There's a lot of older technologies out there that have been in place. But now I think it's in place. It's kind of something that may have a right fit. As technologists, we may be resistant to it. Because if you have a low-code platform, does that mean I don't end up having a lot to code? Wait a second, I'm a coder. Who wants to do that? But the question is, how do you deliver more value for your end clients or for your business? And maybe these platforms let you do that. So instead of delivering 4 applications a year, do you deliver 12? The end is the work is the same, but the output is greater. So being open to thinking about those options and bringing them up is pretty important.
Yeah, it's the right tool for the job too. Maybe of those 12 projects, 100% fit the no-code app. You might as well use the big building blocks to snap this together like Legos instead of working with atoms. We've seen that with SharePoint sometimes. That ends up being the right solution. They've already got AD. They can already authenticate. It's basically just a list with some workflow and it's out there. But speaking of projects with clients, one thing that comes up with us sometimes is, do they want to go fixed bid or do they want to go time and materials? And what are the benefits of each? And another consultant stereotype is, oh, you want time and materials, so you can just let the meter run forever. But at least in our case, no, we've got a big incentive to come in at or under that number so that there is repeat business there. You only get one trip through the door. What's your experience with T&M and fixed bid?
I mean, I grew up in fixed bid, actually, in Cambridge Technology Partners. One of the secret sauce in Cambridge Technology Partners was everything was a fixed bid. And I think that worked in many cases, but when it didn't work, it didn't work. My point of view on it is I'm not a fan of fixed bid for larger programs. For small things, certainly it'll work. I believe that it creates the wrong behavior potentially on both sides. You're bound by this fixed bid, which is scope, time, and dollars. And me as the consultant, now I'm trying to get it all done and squeeze it into those dollars over that time. So what trade-offs am I making? And you as the client, you maybe aren't as focused on it because you're saying, well, either way, if it goes over by 50%, it's your problem, not mine. Right. And then we're not partnering for success over time. So I would say many times I resist it greatly, fixed bid. I'm a big fan of T&M, big fan of retained team models, right? But all tied to outcomes. And we use the term a lot. I said, I'm a big fan of T&M with a fixed price mindset. So we have the right constructs within the contract and we have the right agreement on scope. But our goal is to get you there within that original number and within a scope that makes you successful. And that's where I think as a business, we've been very successful.
Yeah, one of the other reasons we've gone T&M many times is the one thing you can count on is that stuff is going to change before the end of the project. Requirements are going to change. An end customer is going to want something different. They're going to need to swap out some piece of the architecture. Something's going to happen, and you can pivot a little better under that model, whereas fixed bid, it starts being a change order process, which depending on the company can either be relatively easy or just a slog every step.
Exactly right. Yeah, we definitely are more T&M, but we do both today. And I think it really is going in with your eyes wide open and understanding, having the right agreements up front and knowing that either case, right? I think where projects go wrong is when the two partners don't go in there with kind of, we're all in this together to make this successful. And we do work in very complex multi-vendor environments. So we'll be in projects where there's six other vendors. Two or three of them are direct competitors in two other deals. But in the end, we're all on this project together to deliver this thing for this client, right? And we really thrive in those environments as well.
Now, the finance folks and the clients tend to like fixed bid because you can budget for it, because I know it's going to be exactly X. How do you convince them to do something that may seem more nebulous, like a T&M? Do you use a cap? What do you do?
Yeah, so we will cap it, all right? The other piece is you talk about scope in that T&M. So there is some scope commitment, right, within that agreement. So we do spend a good amount of time up front understanding what we're doing, how we're going to do it, at least to some level. And in a T&M, we might do assessment period for the first month or the first 2 weeks, whatever the right time period is, and then refine that scope and come back with a better fit in an original price range that we provided. So instead of it's going to cost you $10, it's going to be between $10 and $15. And then we assess and come back within the range. So that's been very effective.
Now, I know you guys have been growing rapidly, both organically and through acquisition, right through COVID this year. What's it been like managing mergers, especially during COVID?
Yeah, talk about a time of change, right? Hard enough to manage as a company with COVID going on and the significant amount of unrest and racial tension across the country. We have come together now under a single brand, RightPoint, and Genpact acquired RightPoint back in late October 2019, and we started that unification journey, but it really hit and got very aggressive in February timeframe, late February. And then right as we were getting into that, COVID hit. I think the biggest challenge is in any kind of bringing together two organizations is help people understand the direction, having those frank conversations face to face. How do you get people to really see that you're genuine and buy into this vision of these groups coming together and unifying, and is it going to work? So I would say the big challenge for us, because everything was remote, and at the same time of coming together, we were learning how to work remotely as a company and deliver for our clients in these complex remote environments along with our client base. So it even put another set of wrinkles in there. But what we ended up doing was really over-communicating. I think one of the strongest things we did, we were originally doing like monthly all-hands communications. We went to weekly half-hour communications. We're a very transparent company or group. We just ratcheted up the transparency. I mean, just ratcheted it up. So people really felt like they were coming along with us along this journey. And we did, maybe a little counterintuitively, we pushed harder on the unification than slowed it down because of COVID. Because what we wanted to do was get through it quicker, because you and I, no one knows when this thing is going to be over. It's still going on. We want to get these things working together, get a lot of the process things out of the way so we can get back to working and deal with, yes, the complications of COVID, but not the complications of COVID while you're coming together. So we're just about finished with that journey. Finished the last little bit. October 1st, our last financial system came together and teams are delivering on the same systems, working on the same platforms. And we're on our next challenge. As you probably recently saw, we announced the acquisition of Something Digital this week. And so we're bringing together new commerce capabilities and starting the next journey of unifying.
Yeah, I think I saw Something Digital did a lot around e-com and worked with Marketo. How does that kind of tie in with what you guys are already offering?
We continue to have a very good commerce practice, but there were certain parts that were missing. Something Digital brings, yes, Magento, a strong relation with Adobe, but also a really strong set of capabilities around commerce that'll really expand what we can do here in the US and globally. Yes, we're a US-centric team, but we do have a UK team, an Australia team, and we're carrying that commerce message much more strongly into those regions. One of the fun things when you think about it, right, it's RightPoint, a Genpact company. So we're part of this large multinational company that works with a lot of consumer goods companies on operating their contact centers, optimizing their supply chain, And now I think that having expanded commerce capability, we're going to be able to bring that to those customers in a very strong way. Really exciting.
We've done a lot of work ourselves with banking, insurance, hedge funds, and those folks tend to kind of keep everything close to the chest when it comes to where can you work on stuff? How do you virtually connect to us if you're going to work remotely? Have you seen any sort of relaxation or better accommodation since COVID and financial services clients in particular letting you work remotely more easily?
Yeah, we're seeing they're all willing to let us work remotely, but there's probably two cases in this. The ones you can work remotely until we decide we all have to be back in the office. So there are some situations like that. And then there's others where I think the ways of working have changed, where now they're going to be more remote and be able to have the systems and processes in place to support remote work. For example, how do I get you that laptop in a faster way? And if you're working on site, you walk into the IT office, you pick up the laptop, you enable it, and you go. We have a client now where they ship you a laptop. You do have to walk into, but any of their branches worldwide, you walk into the branch. The manager knows how to do this, sets you up, and in 5 minutes, you're on the network. I mean, that's a change, right? So we're seeing clients relax, seeing clients actually learn better how to provide services and technology that lets you work remotely. So I think coming out of COVID, we'll find more remote work. I think as a company, we'll be more apt for remote work as well and have our teams maybe spread out a little more. And I'm pretty sure we all won't go back to how we were working back before March in 21 and forward.
Yeah, I think there's going to be less commercial real estate, more remote adaptation around. And yeah, I think we're seeing the exact same thing. So when you're not advising clients on strategy or folding in acquisitions, what are you doing for fun? I understand you play some soccer.
Yeah, so I'm an avid soccer player. I play in a couple of groups and a couple of teams. So that's a way to stay relaxed and stay fit. That's kind of what I do. And I say I'm still a tinkerer. I have a lot of complete projects and a lot of half-done projects around the house, whether it's setting up some new network or my latest project is quite fun. It's a at-home hot tub heater that I'm building for outdoors based upon some propane and an outdoor heater and a variety of different things. I'm in the process of putting that together, and I'm trying to think about what I can do with my computer to control that and control the temperature more accurately.
Do you use IFT at all?
Yes.
IFT, this, then that? Yeah. We've done some cool home automations with them.
Yeah. One of the great things about now is there's pretty much nothing you can't do. The question is, how do you come up with the idea and get a bunch of people behind you to then make this thing happen? I saw a new thing where there was a new AI platform announced this week. I don't remember the name that I'm actually planning to order. You can do so much in this small little AI box. That's my next thing on the radar.
So Damien, thank you very much for joining us and sharing your insights and experience with us.
Andrew, thanks for having me. Enjoyable conversation. I love thinking about one, the past, but also how we're applying this going forward. So it's been a fun walk down memory lane for me.
Absolutely. And we'll talk to all of you next time on the next episode of Underserved.